All right, good evening, everyone. What a delight to welcome you to the Or Zarua Beit Midrash, the library here. What a delight and honor and privilege to really celebrate our 30th birthday together and continue the life of our congregation with the commitment to intellectual investigation of our tradition, our core sources, to find inspiration for our religious lives and to appreciate the scholarship in and of itself. In the name of Lucy Davidovich, this lecture annually comes to explore that intersection between great scholarship, especially the focus of great women in Jewish studies in the last few years. And we have had many a wonderful scholar come through, but I'll tell you tonight, you're in for an absolute treat. And I say treat with kind of all that it confers in terms of meaning. Meaning that I'm sure tonight will be interesting and intellectually very engaging, and it will almost taste sweet. Because my experience learning with Dr. Hayes this past summer at a rabbinical institute among many colleagues at the Hartman Institute was that sweet. I said to Dr. Hayes when I reached out at first that I had not seen our texts brought to life and performed in the way that Dr. Hayes filled this Beit Midrash of hundreds of rabbis from her perch as the professor of religious studies in classical Judea at Yale University and her perch as leading scholar at the Hartman Institute of North America, who was in Jerusalem to teach. She was there to inspire us to think about how rabbinic texts about Derech Eretz, about being a mensch, about menschlichkeit in general, about a Jewish ethic that's supposed to inform our life, how it was supposed to inform all we do, who we are, and what it's really about to have that value permeate society, not only our society as a Jewish community, but society in general. I left there practically on fire, but it was the fire you lit. And I think everyone agreed that you lit that fire. And that because of your erudition with scholarship and also your belief that humanity has told a unique story vis-a-vis Jewish text. That comes out in who you are and what you write about. And we're delighted to welcome you here for this lecture. Her recent book, What's Divine About Jewish, About Divine Law, What's Divine About Divine Law, Early Perspectives, received the 2015 National Jewish Book Award in Scholarship, a 2016 Prose Award in Theology and Religious Studies from the American Publishers Association, a 2016 Jordan Schnitzer Award from the Association of Jewish Studies. She's written about Between the Babylonian and Palestinian Talmuds, Gentile Impurities and Jewish Identities, which was a National Jewish Book Award finalist, 2003, The Emergence of Judaism, Introduction to the Bible. When it came to rabbinic text, I heard her say that she had to pursue this study because she was missing the heart and soul of this unique cultural expression, religious identity, peoplehood we have as a Jewish people. And I believe you are adding depth, dimension, and excitement and sweetness to Jewish culture through your studies. We are so lucky to have you here in our Beit Midrash tonight.
Thank you so much. So let's be very clear from the beginning. There's no way any human being can live up to that introduction. So thank you so much. Thank you, Rabbi Bolton, for the kind invitation, and also to Mark Ashley, who I think probably has something to do with this as well. And thank you to both of your families for the lovely dinner tonight. I'm so happy to be here. I want to make sure everyone can hear me. Is that good? All right. So what I want to talk about is the fact that a little more than 2,000 years ago, some Jews began to think of the Torah as conveying an unchanging universal truth. And other ancient Jews pushed back against that way of thinking. And the consequences of that debate reverberate to this very day. And I'd like to explore that debate with you today, to explain it a little bit, and to understand why it was and how it was that some Jews began to think of the Torah as immutable truth, and when and why others resisted that, we need to trace the history of the idea of divine law and what it even means to say that a law is divine. And what I want to show you is that there were two very different conceptions of divine law that came out of the ancient world. They collided with one another, and we've all been wrestling with the consequences ever since. So divine law, what do we mean by divine law? Divine law can be described as the idea that the norms that guide human conduct are somehow rooted in the divine realm. What that might mean, we'll discuss in a minute. But it's an idea that we find in Judaism and in Christianity and Islam. But it's not an inevitable idea. Not all cultures have this idea. I'm not an expert, but I've been told by people that Chinese culture, for example, has a different notion of where ethical norms come from, the wisdom of the elders and so on, or ancestors. But it's not an inevitable idea. But it's an idea that arises at roughly the same moment in history in two ancient cultures. It arises among the Greeks in ancient Greece, and it arises among the Israelites, where we see it in the Hebrew Bible. And this is where the story really begins, and this is why the story begins. Because to the extent that the ancient Greeks and the ancient Israelites conceive of the divine in very different ways, they're going to conceive of divine law in very, very different ways. Their ideas are going to diverge dramatically, and that's going to have very, very serious consequences for people in the ancient world who felt the pull of both of those ideas. Okay? So we're going to ask what it means to say that a law is divine. What qualities are we conferring on a law when we say that it's divine? What are the traits that we suppose it possesses? What's divine, or what's so divine, is what I really wanted to call my book, was what's so divine about divine law, but they wouldn't let me. They made me take the so out. So I have to save my humor for my next book. That's what I'm working on in my next book. So I want to spend just 3 minutes with you first considering the Greco-Roman tradition, and then we'll look at the biblical understanding of divine law, and then we'll look at what happens when a young man named Alexander, at the ripe old age of 23, I think, conquers the eastern end of the ancient Mediterranean and brings these two ideas together, and what happens. So first, looking at the Greek idea. In much Greek thought, divine law is divine because it expresses the profound structures of a permanent natural order. The Stoics, they were a school of Greek philosophy, and they were first to actually use the phrase divine law in Greek. It's theos nomos, divine law. And by that, they meant a natural law, what we tend to think of today as natural law. A rational order. They said it was reason itself that informs the universe. It informs nature, and it informs human nature. For the Stoics, God was nature. Nature was divine. And therefore, the rational order, or the reason that governs the cosmos, is natural law. So for them, natural law is an unwritten disposition of reason, if you will, the logical or orderly nature of the environment, of the cosmos. So Cicero, who's a Roman writer, but he reports on the Greek notion of divine law, and he gives us our best definition of divine law according to the Stoics, and that should be the first text on your handout, where he says that there is only one true law, right reason, which is in accordance with nature and applies to everyone. This is what he says. True law, when we use the word law, true law is right reason itself. Logos is the word he uses. In agreement with nature, diffused over everyone, right? It's universal, everlasting. It's wrong to alter this law. You can't even do that. Nor is it permissible to repeal any part of it. It's impossible to abolish it, right? It's the law of nature. There will not be a different law at Rome or at Athens or a different law now or in the future. It is one law, everlasting, immutable. It holds good for all peoples at all times. It's a law of nature. I can't repeal the law of gravity, right? It's that kind of thing. So for the Stoics then, divine law is rational, it's true, it's universal, it's eternal and unchanging or immutable. It's static in its perfection. But their notion of the divine was that it's static, the static, unmoved first principle. But very important for them, divine law was unwritten. It's not a set of rules conveyed in words or statements. It's rational order itself. Now, Stoic thought and in fact Greek thought in general, assumes an important binary. On the one hand, there's natural or divine law that I've just described, but on the other hand, quite separate from that, are the laws that human beings make to govern their society. Human positive law. We call it positive law because humans posit it, right? So there's divine natural law, and then there's human positive law. Concrete rules and prohibitions that are delivered in written form. They govern particular communities. They're not universal. Positive law is particular to the society that issues it. And they're subject to change, of course, and evolution over time. They don't necessarily reflect truth or reality. I don't stop at a red light because there's something about redness that makes me stop, right? When I stop at a red light, I do it because we've posited that that's what we should do as a society. We could have chosen blue. We could have chosen a different color. But that there's nothing about it inherently that I have to obey. I agree. It's a convention that we posit and we obey it, right? So we need, according to the Greeks, we need the positive laws of the state because we lack the rational perfection that we that would enable us to see the rational order in nature or to see the rational forms of truth and justice and just follow them and achieve virtue without the need for law. Unfortunately, there aren't rationally perfect sages among us, except according to Plato, Socrates, maybe on a good day, but not all the time. If we were rational sages and we could perceive the true forms of justice and fairness and goodness and so on, we wouldn't need any laws to govern us. We would naturally be virtuous. So reason could lead us to virtue. But unfortunately, none of us ever reaches that rational perfection, mostly because we live in bodies, which get hungry and tired, so we can't study as much as we should. But if we didn't have bodies and were just rational creatures, we wouldn't need laws. That's the Greek idea. So if you were to ask a Stoic, right, what's divine about divine law? They would have answered that divine law is divine because of its quality, the character it has, that it is rational and it is true and it's universal because reason is universal. 2 + 2 = 4 in Rome and 2 + 2 = 4 in Athens. Reason tells us this. So it's rational, it's true, it's universal, and it never changes. 2 + 2 will always be 4, now and forever. It's immutable. By contrast, in biblical tradition, the law is divine, not by virtue of any qualities it necessarily has, but because it emanates from a God who is the master of history. Biblical divine law is divine because it's authored by, it's the command of a deity. It's not the expression of an impersonal, natural, or divine reason, the rational order of the cosmos. Divine law is a body of actual legislation and commandments that were given by a divine being, and they express his will. And its authority is therefore grounded not so much in its rational character or its character, but in its commanding source, text 2. Moses went and repeated to the people all the commands of the Lord and all the rules, and all the people answered with one voice, saying, all the things that the Lord has commanded we will do. Moses wrote them down, all the commands of the Lord. Doesn't even matter if you understand it. The obedience is what's important. So in biblical tradition, you have a divine law, and it's written. The Stoics would have thought that was crazy. They did, in fact, think it was crazy. I don't have to guess. It's not a rational order. It's actual concrete legislation formulated in words. And it's designed for a particular community. Indeed, to separate them out from other communities. In Exodus 19, if you faithfully observe my laws, you will be unto me a kingdom of priests, mamlechet kohanim. You will be also an am kadosh, right? A separate kadosh, a separate people. And because it's the positive act of a sovereign commanding will, it's changeable because something that stems from an act of will can be changed by a subsequent act of will. We see this already in the time of Moses when there are new rules and ordinances given when something new happens. Moses 4 times scratches his head and says, somebody's collecting wood on the Sabbath. I don't know what to do. God, what should I do? 4 times he goes and asks God, what should we do? Something new has arisen. Something new has happened. And God has to make a decision about what to do. And Deuteronomy 13 itself says, when you come into the land, you're going to do things differently. You're not going to do them as you're doing them now. Now you offer sacrifices everywhere, but when you come into the land, you'll offer them in a single place. Deuteronomy 17 provides for the ongoing evolution of the law to meet the people's needs. When, after Moses has died, a question arises on some legal matter, you shall repair to the judges of the day, and they will figure out what to do. And, of course, the very famous case of the daughters of Zelophehad, who come to Moses and say, our father has died without a son, and we think it's not fair that his inheritance should go to his brothers. It should perhaps come to his daughters. And Moses says, let me take that up with God. And he goes and speaks to God, and God says, you know, they're right. I think that's fair. Let's do it that way from now on. Write it down. So there's a new situation and new rules, and none of this is problematic in the biblical view. Divine law given by a God who's involved with his people in history is something that meets their ongoing needs. So in the dominant biblical descriptions of divine law, it's not the only one, but it's the dominant one, the divine law expresses God's will for particular people, not universal humankind, in the form of a written law that makes people fit for life in a particular place. And rather than expressing the fixed rational order of a timeless, static nature, it is subject to change in historical time. And ancient adherents to biblical tradition, if you ask them what's divine about divine law, they would have answered by pointing to its origin in a divine will, a will that's expressed in history, rather than a rational order expressed in nature. So you see how we have two very different ideas coming out of the ancient world. And the attribution of divinity to the law itself didn't necessarily confer on it any particular qualities in biblical tradition. Didn't necessarily mean that it was rational or conformed to truth. In fact, sometimes the best way to give someone or a group a particular identity is to have them do certain things that aren't necessarily rational. They aren't things other people would have thought of, right? So the law at Sinai contains some rules that are precisely to set Israel apart and identify Israel as God's. You shall be holy, separate to me. Observe these dietary laws. Observe these purity laws. It wouldn't do to create a people and say, I know what I'll do to make you distinct and separate. We're going to have a law that no one should murder. Because every society has a law that no one should murder. So the rules that mark this particular law as indicating that the Israelites are gods are precisely the non-rational laws, if you will. So you have these two very different ideas of divine law, and they collide, as I said, when Alexander and the Greeks decide to conquer the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and we have an influx of Hellenistic culture and Greek ideas into the land of Israel at this time. And that created a cognitive dissonance for Jews living under Hellenistic rule, under Greek rule, from the 3rd century BCE on. Why did they feel a cognitive dissonance? Because on the face of it, the divine law of biblical tradition possessed many of the features that a Greek thinker would think looked like human law. I've given you a little chart, and that's a little sort of chart that's a description of the Greek idea of divine law. That's column A, and the characteristics of divine law, that it's grounded in reason, that it's it necessarily conforms to truth, it's universal, it's immutable and unchanging and unwritten. And then human law, which is not necessarily conformed to truth, it's written rules and legislation, it's grounded in the will, it might even have some non-rational or arbitrary elements, it's particular to a people, and it evolves with them, it changes, and it's written down. And so Jews living in this period and who cherished their tradition looked at it and realized that in the eyes, perhaps, of the conquering culture, their divine law looked a little peculiar. It tended to have more of the characteristics in column B than A, and I think that made some of them very anxious. That mismatch was troubling and obvious to ancient Jews, and they responded to that cognitive dissonance in three ways, and that's what we'll do now. We're going to look at these. We're going to look at one and two quickly because the one I really enjoy is three, and so we will get to the third one, which is the response of the Talmudic rabbis. But we're going to look at three different responses to this mismatch. The first response I want to consider is the response of Jews who fully embraced Hellenistic values, Hellenistic culture, and this little chart, this Greek definition of what a divine law should look like and what a human law should look like. These Jews did not want to think of their Torah, and they didn't want other people to think of their sacred tradition, their national heritage, as anything other than the divine law according to the definition of the dominant culture that they admired so much. And so they worked like crazy to shoehorn the law of Moses given at Sinai into column A, into the left side of that chart, right? They tried to attribute to the divine law of Moses all of the qualities and characteristics in column A in order to be able to say, yes, this is the divine law according to the Greek understanding of divine law. If you've heard of Philo, he was a first century Jew who lived in Alexandria, a philosopher. He studied and read the Torah in its Greek translation. We don't know that he knew Hebrew, but he embraced Stoic thought. He went to Rome and he studied Stoic thought when he was in Rome. And he very much admired Greek culture, but he also very much loved his own tradition and his own people. But for him, if this was a divine text, then it had to be divine in the sense of all those traits on column A of your chart. And he wanted to prove it. So in his writings, he argued that the law of Moses is in harmony with the principles of eternal nature. I've given you this text as well. Thus, whoever will carefully examine the nature of the particular laws, particular enactments, will find that they seek to attain to the harmony of the universe and are in agreement with the principles of eternal nature. He identified the Torah of Moses with logos, with reason, and with the natural law that governs the cosmos. Now, once he's identified it with the natural law of the Stoics, he goes on to claim that it therefore must possess all the qualities of Greek natural law. It's universal, it's rational, it's truth, and it's unchanging, and it's unwritten. That one really took a lot of chutzpah, okay? First, to support the claim that the Mosaic law is the universal law of the world city, if you will, he ignores the immediate context of the story of the giving of the law, where God says to separate you out from other people, that we give you blessings. No, that's fine. But actually, the whole story begins with the creation of the whole world. And if God is the creator of the whole world and the lawgiver of the world, and he gives the law at Sinai, well, he wouldn't give a law that conflicts with his own creation and the law that he put into the universe at creation. And therefore, the laws at Sinai are essentially the eternal, rational order of the universe as well. Second, he mocks those who think that the Bible is a wonderful collection of history, drama, poetry, literature, and there were many in his day who valued the Torah for those qualities. He said, no, no, it is truth, and that's the next passage I've given you. In the poetic work of God, you will not find anything mythical or fictional, but the canons of truth all inscribed. You just have to know how to read it. If you use the technique of allegory, you can break open the literal meaning of the text and arrive at the philosophical, rational truths that are embedded in the text. Third, he has to deal with the fact that this text is written. And for the Greeks, that would be an unfailing sign that it was human positive law. So he says, no, the written text of the Mosaic Code that we have is simply a copy of the original unwritten law of nature. How does he know this? He says, well, the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they all observed the law. They were virtuous men. And therefore, they obeyed and observed the law before it was given in writing at Sinai. How were they able to do this? Because it is the natural law, and they were sages with rational perfection, and the rationally perfect sage can read the rational order of the cosmos and align his behavior accordingly and follow the natural law. So if the patriarchs were virtuous before the law was given in Sinai, clearly they were following the Torah in the form of natural law. So it's just a written copy of an earlier natural law embedded in the cosmos. Fourth, he says, on the question of change, the law of his people has never changed. That's in text, the next Philo text you have. But Moses is alone in this among lawgivers, that his laws, firm, unshaken, immovable, stamped as it were with the seals of nature herself, remain secure from the day when they were first enacted to now, and will do so for here forward. In short, Philo's answer, and he wasn't the only one. We have other writings that do the same sorts of things from Hellenistic Jewish writers. Philo's answer to the cognitive dissonance between the Stoic idea of divine law and the biblical representation of the divine law given to Israel at Sinai was to refashion the Torah of Moses into natural law. According to Philo, the Torah was divine law according to the Greek understanding of the term, and that meant it was universal, it was utterly rational, it was true, and it is immutable. Now, there was a second response to the cognitive dissonance we've been talking about, and I'm going to mention it briefly because I want to get to number three. And that second response is the response of a Pharisaic Jew in the first century named Paul. I think Paul was like Philo. He had his national heritage. He also saw the definition of divine law in the surrounding culture. But unlike Philo, he concluded, you know, I think the Mosaic law does look more like column B on your chart. I do think it looks more like a human positive law. He called it the law of Moses. He didn't call it really the divine law. He referred to it as the law of Moses, a man. And it's the written constitution for a particular people, and its time is done. It can't lead to virtue. It's not the universal unwritten law of nature, which is written on the hearts of humans. It lacks the features of divine law that we know from Greek culture. It's a particular law for Israelites. It's not one that Gentiles need to follow. Now, Philo and Paul are similar in one way. Both of them accept that little chart on the front page of your handout. They both accept the Greek definition. This is what human law is. This is what divine law is. And then, if you do, you've got to figure out where to put the law of Moses, right? And they simply made different choices. For Philo, he wanted to identify it with the divine law, and therefore he made sure to refashion the law of Moses to have the qualities of divine law, whereas Paul did not. But a third response is the response of the Talmudic rabbis. These are Jewish sages who lived from the 1st century to the 7th century, producing the works that we know as Midrash and Talmud. And for their part, the rabbis looked at that little chart on the first page, and they said, no, thank you. They just walked away from it. They presented a portrait of divine law in defiance of the Greek concept. The rabbinic understanding of divine law, or Torah, challenges the very idea that divine law must be characterized by conformity to truth, universal rationality, and immutability. And so I want to just walk us through each of those attributes in turn and see what the rabbis have to say about the Torah and truth. We'll spend most of our time on that. One text on the Torah and rationality, and one on the Torah and immutability. Does the Torah, in fact, have those characteristics according to the rabbis? And if not, might that be a good thing? So first, let's think about truth. Truth, which is so highly valued in the classic philosophical tradition. Well, there are many fascinating rabbinic texts in which the Torah doesn't necessarily conform to truth. Now, of course, there are different ways that we can think about truth, different kinds of truth. The Greeks had one term for it. Unfortunately, we don't really have anything equivalent in rabbinic texts. The word emet, which is often translated as truth, isn't what the Greeks meant by truth. Emet has more to do with faithfulness, and it's not quite what the rabbis meant, the Greeks meant when they had this idea of truth. So one has to work a little bit to try to understand what the rabbis thought about the Torah and truth. But in my work, I've tried to show that there are four different ways we can think about truth. One is we can think of logical truth. As I've already said, 2 plus 2 equals 4. There are certain things that are logically true. It doesn't matter if I'm counting cups of water or if I'm counting glasses. 2 plus 2 will always equal 4. And even if the entire universe vanished tomorrow and there weren't even things to count, it would still be true that 2 plus 2 equals 4. So there are things that are just logically true. But then there's also judicial truth. That is, when I acquit someone who is innocent and I condemn someone who is guilty, make a judgment about behavior that can be true or false. Also, something can be true in the sense that it seems to correspond with objective reality. It's true that I'm standing on my feet right now. Something can be empirically true. It's true that it's dark outside right now. These are things we can check empirically. And then there's another type of truth as well we'll get to. But it turns out that in rabbinic sources, we see that the rabbis are quite comfortable with the idea that sometimes the Torah deviates from all kinds of truth. Not necessarily. Sometimes it does, but sometimes it deviates from truth. And I will give you an example first of the way Torah can deviate from logical truth. Now, this is a little tiny little bit of Midrash, and it can sort of make you cross your eyes, but just bear with me. We'll get through this. These are the parts of Talmud that I think are so much fun. And I've chosen one example, and I could have chosen one of hundreds. This happens hundreds and hundreds of times in rabbinic texts, where they take the time to point out that the divine law, that the Torah, doesn't agree with formal truth. My logic would lead me astray, and I need scripture to tell me that something is not what I would logically have come to. All right, so let's take a look at text 4. This is talking about meal offerings or cereal offerings, right, a mincha. And it's saying, first they do a little logical argument. Cereal offerings might logically, badin is the phrase they use in Hebrew, might logically be thought to require the purest olive oil. And here's how I reason towards that. For if the menorah, which is not intended for consumption, requires the purest olive oil, then the meal offerings, which are intended for consumption, isn't it logical that they should require, you fill in the blank, right, the purest oil, right? So it's a kind of, you know, from the lesser to the greater kind of case, right? So you see how logic would teach us that if I use the purest oil for a purpose when I don't eat it, then of course I should at least use the purest or even more for something I do eat. But now here comes the big reveal. But look at what Scripture says. It says in Exodus 27:20, you're going to use pure olive oil beaten for the light. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read that, I don't think it says anything about cereal offerings. It just says pure olive oil beaten for the light. But the rabbis are going to do a diuk, right? They're going to do one of these moves where pure olive oil davka for the light, which means precisely not for anything else, including cereal offerings. Look at that. Logic led us astray. Does everybody see what they did here? Right? They first use logic to arrive at some idea of what the law should be, and then they massage out of this verse a different ruling. And you have to ask yourself why. And they do this hundreds and hundreds of times, as if to say, logical truth isn't what it all is. And Torah tells us other things that we can't arrive at through reason. And this, of course, would have made Philo roll over in his grave. Because Philo spent so much of his life going through the individual laws of the Torah and rushing to explain why each one was rational. And all of the dietary laws, he goes through and explains why each one is rational. And this particular animal we don't eat because it has the nature of a predator, and it's to teach you not to be a predator. And this animal we do eat because it's domesticated and kind, and it teaches you to be kind. He spends his life showing that there's nothing irrational, nothing non-rational, I should say, in the Torah. And here the rabbis will hundreds and hundreds of times show us that reason would not tell us what God wants of us. Sometimes we need God to simply give us a law. We can't arrive at it ourselves. So we follow Scripture's dictates follow Scripture's rulings against the dictates of formal logic. And they take time again and again to make this claim. The distinction between maybe the logically correct or formally correct law and what the Divine Torah actually is, that continues also in the area of judgment, not just in sort of logic, but also in areas of judicial rulings or judgment. Here, too, the divine law can deviate from judicial truth. When it comes to adjudicating the law, the rabbis say, the overzealous, uncompromising adherence to truth, the single correct answer that might emerge from studying the law, or theorizing about right and wrong, that's depicted in several texts as being quite dangerous. In fact, the rabbis say that Jerusalem was destroyed because people stood on the Din HaTorah, on the strict line of the law, when they should have been lifnim mishurat HaTorah. They should have stopped short of strict justice and perhaps waived their rights or not insisted on their rights. Sometimes the world is a better place when instead of thinking about what's strictly or justice or strictly right, you think about what's good. And Torah judgments that are theoretically correct can be very destructive in practice. The pious judge, they say, will apply the laws of the Torah with a consideration for a range of values. Not only truth, and truth is a value, and 99% of the time that will be what you want, but it is one value, and sometimes it might be set aside because of other values, like mercy, or compassion, or charity, or in the interests of peace. God, too, they say, judges best when he doesn't judge solely according to the truth. There's a tradition in the Talmud in Tractate Avodah Zarah which says that the best time to come before God in judgment is in the second part of the day, because in the first part of the day, he's studying Torah in a theoretically sort of abstract way, and he's dealing with truth. In the second part of the day, he gets up and he sits on the seat, he moves from the seat of judgment to the seat of mercy, and then he's willing to judge with other factors, to moderate strict truth with, you know, mercy and other considerations of other values. So truth is important, but it can be destructive if one clings to it in a zealous way. So God himself is said to sometimes defeat truth. There's a wonderful book that's just been written, and it has a chapter that describes rabbinic texts that picture various characters coming up for judgment in the heavenly court. And God does everything he can to sabotage the prosecuting attorney and to make sure that the defense attorney has extra time on the clock and can plead forgiveness, and makes it very clear that he will do everything he can to subvert truth and judgment for the sake of sustaining his people, right? There might be a larger good. So sometimes Torah deviates not just from logical truth, not just from judicial truth, but also from empirical truth, physical reality, physical facts. The Torah doesn't always align with this. In Greek thought, of course, that would make no sense. Natural law is the law of nature, and so it is exactly how nature behaves. But the divine law in biblical tradition does not necessarily have to conform with physical reality. So there's a very famous passage in the Mishnah, in Tractate Rosh Hashanah, involving the declaration of the calendar. Here, the head of the court, Rabbi Gamliel, is said to accept obviously false testimony. My astronomy and my astronomical knowledge is not great, but evidently what these witnesses report they see in the sky astronomically cannot happen. They claim to have seen the new moon, and then the next night it's gone. So something like that. But he accepts their testimony, and he declares the new moon. Other rabbis say to him, how can you do that? This is clearly false. It's clearly not the first of the month. And that's the problem. If you declare this to be the first of the month, then people will think Yom Kippur falls on this day, the 10th day, and they will fast on that day, and then the next day they will eat, but that's the real Yom Kippur, and that's a big deal, because as we know, violation of the laws of Yom Kippur results in karet, extirpation of your line from Israel. So this is a big deal. We need to get this right. And Rabbi Gamliel prevails. The rabbinic court and humans in general have the right to set the calendar, and they do not have to be controlled by astronomical reality. There might be other considerations, including certain conveniences of the calendar and the hardships created when certain days fall close to Sabbath and so on, right? So the Torah doesn't need to line up with nature, and justification for this view is found in Scripture. This is text 5, where Rabbi Akiva comforts someone else by saying, it's fine, it's already licensed to us that we have the ability to declare the calendar in this way, in a way that might even deviate from astronomical reality. Why? There are 3 verses in Scripture that say you can fix the calendar, you can declare the festival or the holy days. 3 times it says you. And so he uses those 3 occurrences to teach the following teaching. Rabbi Akiva then said to Rabbi Yoshua, the text says you, 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 3 times to indicate that you may fix the festivals even if you err inadvertently, you, even if you err deliberately, and you, even if you are misled. It's still the calendar. And Rabbi Yoshua replied to him saying, Akiva, you have comforted me, you have comforted me. Similarly, the rabbinic interpretation of Torah tolerates counterfactual rulings and legal fictions if they help to achieve humane and compassionate goals, such as the famous case of the woman who remarries after witnesses report that her husband is dead. He's overseas, and witnesses come and say the husband's dead, and she remarries, and then he shows up. And there is one early sage, Rav, who says, we simply say to the man, you are not he, and employ a legal fiction so that her new marriage is not disrupted. This happened in Ohio. I will tell you, some years ago, someone's husband disappeared, and after a long period of time, he was declared dead, and she collected Social Security for 30 years, and then he showed up. And the court couldn't possibly have her return 30 years worth of Social Security, and they declared that he was not himself. This happened in Ohio. So,
they read the Talmud.
They read the Talmud, obviously. So fictive legal presumptions are also tolerated, such as the presumption that all women are in a state of ritual purity from menstruation when their husbands return from a journey. Now, clearly, this will not always factually be true. But the facts are not the sole determinant of the law when sometimes there's a larger good, such as the promotion of marital intimacy or procreation, right, when that can be achieved. And so there's a balancing. There's one last measure of truth that we have to consider, and that is authorial truth. That is to say, the truth intended by the author of the law or the text that author has given. In their attempts to interpret and apply Torah law, are the rabbis bound by the truth or the meaning of the text as intended by its divine author? Or can rulings of divine law deviate even from the divine author's intention? That's the question behind one of the most famous stories. I always have tried to avoid giving this talk or versions of this talk. I try to avoid this text because it's the one text everybody knows, and I like to show that actually you don't need this text to make this case. It's throughout rabbinic literature. But someone recently asked me to start adding it, so I have, because generally someone will ask the question at the end. The famous story from Bava Metzia in the Babylonian Talmud, where Rabbi Eliezer is locking horns with all of the other sages over the status of a particular oven. Is it ritually pure or is it ritually impure? And the rabbis have all declared it in one state, and he has declared it in another. He says it's pure. And there are arguments, but after all of the arguments have been exhausted, Rabbi Eliezer resorts to miraculous feats to prove his interpretation is correct. And so he says, if I am correct, let this carob tree jump in the air. If I am correct, let the stream of the water run backwards, the water of the stream run backwards. If I'm correct, let the walls of the schoolhouse fall. The carob tree jumps in the air. The water runs backward. The schoolhouse walls start to fall. But his colleagues say, that's lovely, but that's not an argument. And they are not convinced. And so Rabbi Eliezer appeals to a higher authority, and that's where we pick up the story here. Text 6. He said to them, if the halakha, if the law agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven. Forget the carob trees, the water, the walls. I'm going straight to the source. Let it be proved from heaven. Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, you know, why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that in all matters the halakha agrees with him? But Rabbi Yoshua arose and he exclaimed, citing Deuteronomy, it is not in heaven. Famous passage where Moses says, the Torah is not in heaven. It's not outside this world. You don't have to go far. It's here. God gave it to you in your hands. Do something with it. Right? So Rabbi Yoshua says, no, it is not in heaven. What did he mean by this? Rabbi Jeremiah or Yirmiyah said, the Torah has already been given at Mount Sinai from heaven to earth, so we pay no attention to a heavenly voice. Because you, God, have long since written in the Torah at Mount Sinai, after the majority one must incline. We go by the majority. If he failed to convince us through his argument, what else do we do? We can't rely on miracles and jumping trees. We have to convince one another in communities of justice. Rabbi Nathan, or Natan, met Elijah. Whenever the rabbis need to have a way to have God weigh in on something in a story, Elijah is a useful character for them. Not having died, he's a frequent traveler between heaven and earth. So he's a literary device when we need to know what God is thinking. So Rabbi Natan met Elijah, and he asked him, what did the Holy One, blessed be he, do in that hour when Rabbi Yehoshua said to him, you know, you've got to vote God, but not a veto. And it's really up to us to figure it out. The answer is, God laughed with joy and said, my children have conquered me. My children have conquered me. So this heavenly voice indicates that the divine author himself agrees with the legal ruling of Rabbi Eliezer. That's the true authorial meaning. But even that is not proof of the ruling's rightness or goodness. Unless Rabbi Eliezer can produce an actual argument that can convince others of his view, then the law must be decided in accordance with the majority. So for the rabbis, no miracle, not even a heavenly affirmation of the author's intended meaning can determine the divine law, because even though the Torah is from heaven, it is no longer in heaven. Control over the interpretation and the administration of the Torah has been ceded by God to admittedly fallible human beings who must follow the best practices of argumentation, moral reasoning, and majority rule. And God is said in this text to even celebrate the bold assertion of rabbinic authority, even if it is at the expense of his own authority, and even if it leads to error. What God may have intended in a particular law is not the only factor in determining the law. And he's handed his Torah to humans, and now not even miracles or the divine voice itself can overturn an interpretation that's agreed upon by the majority. So right or wrong, those who study the Torah and interpret it in good faith are free of the control by the text's author. So we've seen that the rabbi's understanding and portrait of divine law doesn't assume that it conforms to some objective standard of unchanging truth that we just have to discover, this unchanging standard of truth. The meaning and the truth of it is something we have to work towards always with our argumentation and our reasoning and our thinking about different values and weighing what is good. Nor do the rabbis think that the Torah's laws are entirely rational. So that was the second quality. We were going to see, does the Torah always adhere to truth? Is it always rational? Is it always immutable? One very quick text on the question of whether the Torah is always rational. They think that not all of the laws are necessarily rational or accessible to universal reason, things that we would arrive at through reason. Some are, certainly. They say this quite explicitly. There are things that, had they not been written in the Torah, we would know to write them, like murder and certain sexual sins and so on. Every society reasons their way toward those things. But there are things, they say, we really would not have thought to put in there, like taking off your shoe to escape from a levirate marriage, or to dissolve the bond of a levirate marriage, or the ritual of the red heifer. Wouldn't have come up with that one on our own, right? So, but some of these laws are there, and they say, but not only are they in the divine law, they're the ones that mark it as truly divine law. Every human legal system has some of these other rational laws. But the laws that mark the Torah as distinctly divine are precisely the non-rational ones, the purity laws, the dietary laws, other ritual laws that are commanded only to Israel and mark Israel as God's special covenant people. And while it's very good to obey all of the laws, they see a special virtue arising from observance of the commandments that have no clear rationale, are arbitrary, or even counter to our own natural desires. And this is what we read in text 7. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, how do we know that a person should not say, okay, you should not say, you know, it's okay, I don't want to wear mixed fibers, right? You know, there's a law that prohibits the wearing of mixed fibers, linen, and okay. So if you shouldn't say, that's okay, I don't want to wear mixed fibers, or, you know what, it's okay, I don't really want to eat pork, right? Or, I don't want to commit an incestuous sexual act. But rather, you should say, you know, I do want to do all those things, but what can I do? For my Father in heaven has imposed his decree on me, and I'm doing it out of obedience to that, not because it serves me or because it fits in my natural but because it was commanded. So non-rational divine laws, like the prohibition of pork, that natural reason wouldn't dictate and may even seem to go against human nature. In fact, you should manufacture the idea that they're going against your nature. I really want to do that, but I can't. These are opportunities for the rabbis to show obedience, to earn reward. And in many passages, the rabbis will point to some commandment, maybe a non-rational one, and say, what can we do? It's the decree of a king, and we obey it because it is the decree of the king. Finally, on the question of whether the divine law is immutable, unchanging. According to the rabbis, it is not immutable in that sense. The covenant is, in the sense that God and Israel will always be bound in covenant. But the terms of the divine law itself are not necessarily immutable. On the contrary, the Torah is susceptible to moral critique and modification. And rather than being a sign of its imperfection, this flexibility is the very mark of its divinity. On many occasions, the rabbis will state what the divine law is and then say, but you know what? We're going to set that aside in favor of something better. Better in the sense of being morally better. We see this in a tractate of the Mishnah called Mishnah Gittin, chapters 4 and 5 in Mishnah Gittin. They list a whole series of ordinances that the rabbis make to adjust the divine law in the interests of peace, or mipnei tikkun olam, for the sake of the public social welfare, or for the public good. So for example, even though according to Torah law, they say a husband can annul a divorce document, so he may have issued a divorce document, then he can change his mind and annul it without telling his wife. By Torah law, they say he has that right. But you know what? We're going to rule that you can't for the sake of the social order. The poor woman might think she's divorced and might act accordingly, and there could be a mess, and you don't do that to people. So the Torah law is this, but we think a better way to do something would be to prevent that. Although by Torah law, a slave who's owned by two masters, if one of them frees, then he's half free and half slave. And the rabbis say, by Torah law, you can do that. But what is the poor man going to do? He'll never be able to marry. Because a slave cannot marry a free person, a free person cannot marry a slave, he will have no partner. And therefore, we don't allow that, right? So we have to be involved in thinking through the consequences of the law. And humans are an essential partner to God. The divine law doesn't always dictate the best or most moral answer. It's a starting point, and humans are the essential partner in critiquing the law and making it better, often just based on a sense, intuitive sense, that it's not fair or doesn't seem to achieve a good. In fact, the rabbis maintain that humans have enormous power to critique and modify a divine decree. And some texts are quite explicit in representing their aggressive criticism of some elements of the divine law. And there are fascinating sources that describe God being corrected or taught by the moral insights and arguments of humans. There's a book that was just published by a young scholar called Pious Irreverence. He collects 140 of these texts from rabbinic literature from the 3rd to the 7th century in which God is confronted by some human, and they're often biblical characters, but they confront him about something that they find objectionable in the law or that just could be better. And there's an argument about it, and sometimes they get a little aggressive. Sometimes God has an answer. He has an answer. Sometimes he rejects the critique or ignores it. But sometimes he significantly, courageously admits his flaws, and he'll adopt a different stance. He might change the way he does things or change a rule and modify his behavior. Text 8 is an example of one where God concedes to Moses' criticism over the principle of vicarious punishment. So, of course, you know in Exodus 34, when God introduces himself, he describes himself as the God who visits the guilt of the parents upon the children, right? When the Holy One, blessed be he, said to him, visiting the guilt of the parents upon the children, Moses said, let's think about that. Master of the world, how many evil people give birth to righteous people? Shall they take punishment from the sins of their parents? Terah worshipped idols, and Abraham, his son, was righteous. And also, Hezekiah was righteous, and his father Ahaz was a wicked man. And Josiah was righteous, his father Amon was wicked, etc. Is it appropriate, yafeh, I think is the word they use there, is it nice, is it appropriate that righteous people shall receive lashes for the sins of their parents? And God said to him, you know, you've taught me something. By your life, I will nullify my decree and establish your word. And the rabbis say, that's why in Ezekiel, God says, I'm not going to do this anymore. Every man will die for his own sin. How do we account for the difference from Exodus to, you know, Ezekiel? Moses got God's ear and had a word with him about maybe a better way to do things. So God learns from Moses, and he annuls his decree, and he establishes a new rule of individual punishment. In another case, Moses teaches God that you should sue for peace before engaging in war. This is how the rabbis account for another shift in the Bible where God tells Moses to attack, but Moses first speaks to someone, and so Moses was teaching God that there might be a better way to do things, to negotiate first. There's another case, they say, where Moses, originally a law was punished by death, and Moses negotiated over that with God, and so instead lashes are given instead of a capital punishment for that particular sin. It's a very short distance, I think, from the view that God consents to and is desirous of human assistance to modify the strict justice of his own decrees to the view that he needs it. And we have a dramatic illustration of God's dependence on human intervention to defeat him in the execution of his own flawed decrees. And we find this in a passage from Exodus Rabbah. This is the rabbinic interpretation of the book of Exodus. This is an interpretation. This is dealing with the story of the golden calf, which I hope is familiar to you all. So as you know, according to the story in Exodus 32, God is infuriated with the Israelites' disloyalty. Things are just wrapping up. He's just finishing up 40 days with Moses. He's handing over the tablets. The covenant is just about to be sealed after all of this time and hardship. And then God says, get down from here. Your people, I love that. You know what your son did today? Your people that you brought out of Egypt have sinned against me, etc. And you'll notice when Moses answers, he says, no, your people. They keep throwing the people back and forth. It's a great story. But he's furious, and he tells Moses to stand back, leave me alone. My anger will blaze forth. I will lash out, and I will destroy them, and I'll start all over again with you. And Moses, despite being given the order to stand back, very courageously, the next text is Vayachal Moshe et Pnei Hashem, or something like that. Vayachal Moshe, Moses implores. He begins to pray and plead with God, as we then read in the text. So he doesn't obey this command, even though God has said, leave me alone. I'm going to destroy them and start with you. Vayachal Moshe, he pleaded with God not to destroy the people. Now, the rabbis pick up very playfully on this word, Vayachal, the root of that, Chol, is a root that can mean several things. It can refer to annulling a vow. Hechal is the word that's used to annul a vow in Numbers. And so this is what this particular midrash says. I think this is a version of the text I gave you. It's long, and I condensed it. Another explanation of what Moses implored, Vayachal Moshe et Pnei Hashem, the Lord his God, what does this mean? It means that he absolved Hechal, his creator, of his vow. How? When Israel made the calf, Moses began to entreat God to forgive them. But God said, Moses, I've already taken an oath back there in Exodus 22:19. Weren't you listening? I said, whoever sacrifices to a God other than me alone shall be proscribed or destroyed. I can't retract an oath that has proceeded from my mouth. Right? So according to the Rabbinic Midrash, God desperately wants to forgive Israel, but he can't. He's trapped by his law, condemning idolaters to death. Right? And he's stuck. He's trapped. He's got to kill them. So Moses is thinking very quickly, and Moses says, okay, Lord of the universe, just read ahead a little bit. Number 30, verse 3. Didn't you grant me the power of annulment of oaths? After all, in Numbers 30, verse 3, it says, if a man makes a vow, he shall not break, yachel, his pledge, meaning that he himself cannot break his own pledge, but a scholar can absolve his vow if he consults him. Another diuk, right? And he goes on to say, in a part that I've left out, that every good teacher should always model his teachings to his students, so really you should be the first to make use of this particular law. So having persuaded God to this course of action, Moses sits like a sage to hear God's petition for the annulment of his own vow, and the Midrash describes the scene. Thereupon Moses wrapped himself in his cloak, the cloak of a scholar, and he seated himself like a sage, and the Holy One, blessed be he, stood before him like one petitioning for the annulment of his vow. I have this image in my mind. I love it. God's got his hat in his hand, looking very sheepish. I really said a stupid thing. I don't mean it's beautiful. And what did Moses say to him? He said a shocking thing. Do you now regret your vow? And he said to him, I regret now the evil which I said I would do to my people. That's actually a direct line right out of the story, if you recall, after Moses persuades God, and it says, although in the third person, and the Lord vayinachem, he regretted of the evil that he said he would do to his people. So they just took that line from the Bible and put it in God's first person speech. I regret now the evil I said I would do to my people. And when Moses heard this, he said, it is absolved for you. There is neither vow nor oath any longer. And he absolved the vow of his creator. This is an astonishing portrait of a God trapped by his own law of justice and truth. Idolaters, you know, should be killed. And unless it's modified, however, it will lead to destruction and bring to an end this grand experiment with the people of Israel. It's a picture of a God who's dependent upon the ingenious intervention of a human partner who can help him escape the devastating dictates of his own divine law. This idea of a morally evolving divine being, one who's involved right here with us in the midst and the hurly-burly of life and figuring things out, a God whose law should be subjected to testing and moral critiquing and modification if necessary, that stands at a very great distance from the Greek conception of divinity and the perfect, static, unchanging nature of divine law or rational order and the unmoved mover who is a static divine being. To modify divine law on the basis of practical reasoning or considerations of mercy or equity, that would be nonsense to the Greeks. That would be like saying, you know, let's change the law of gravity so that I can drop something without breaking it. That would be really handy. It doesn't work that way. And for the Greeks, the divine law was this uniform, inflexible, unchanging order. It would just make no sense to speak of setting it aside or overruling it or in order to achieve some moral good or some social good. In fact, for the Greeks, the opposite is the case. The divine natural law never changes. Human laws should be tweaked. And in fact, we don't even have to obey them if they go against the natural law, right? But that's not what we find in rabbinic sources. They're almost the reverse of that. They depict divine law as the thing that undergoes adjustment in order to conform to human experience and human moral intuition. And the ability of the divine law, as I said before, is not to evolve, is not a mark of its imperfection. A rigid, unresponsive law that wreaks havoc or does destruction, that would be imperfect. So The law's divinity is not diminished in the eyes of the rabbis by the fact that it is particular, flexible, dynamic, and responsive, rather than universal, static, and unchanging. Its divinity and its greatness is constituted by these features, and humans are essential and active partners in the divine law's ongoing evolution and revelation. So to sum up, I've argued that the rabbis of the Talmudic era did not shy away from attributing to the divine Torah features that would have been considered by their neighbors, others in antiquity, to be unfailing indicators of a positive human law. The divine law of the God of Israel is not necessarily allied with truth. It's not entirely rational and universal. It's not invariable and immutable. In that respect, the rabbis, almost in a strange way, resemble Paul a little bit more than Philo. But unlike Paul, the rabbis continued to insist on the divine status and the enduring relevance of the Torah. Paul saw that as something that denigrated the law. For them, this is what made the law precisely divine. And in that sense, they're a bit more like Philo, because Philo also believed that the law was divine. But in another respect, they resembled neither Philo nor Paul. And that is in the fact that they confirmed the biblical notion of a divine law whose very divinity is enhanced rather than harmed by its divorce from truth, by its particular and sometimes non-rational character, by its susceptibility to moral critique and modification in response to the shifting circumstances of human experience. And in all of that, they were entirely unique, and they were entirely scandalous. To anyone who accepted the Greek conception of divine law, and that was pretty much most of the people around them, the idea that the divine law wouldn't be self-identical with truth, that divine law wouldn't be universal and unchanging, was shocking and indeed laughable. And I believe that the rabbis knew that. Theirs was a very self-aware choice. I say that because in rabbinic literature we have dozens upon dozens of texts in which the rabbis explicitly represent themselves in conversation with outsiders, maybe a philosopher or a heretic or someone, and that person is mocking them for their conception of divine law. You really think a divine law would tell you you can't eat certain foods? You really think a divine law, and it's very interesting to read those particular passages, but the fact that they could write those stories and put that view in the mouth of others means they are aware of what's at stake, and they know what other people think a divine law should look like, and they reject that idea. They depict themselves as mocked by those who claim that a divine law must be rational, unchanging truth, and therefore they signal to us that they're very aware and consciously rejecting that view. In the medieval and modern periods after the Talmud, the rabbinic conception of divine law starts to be overshadowed in the West, and even in some of Jewish tradition. The Greek binary on the front page of your handout, that Greek binary between divine natural law and human law, that becomes kind of a controlling paradigm in the West in general, and in the conception of divine law and the laws of states, or natural law and the laws of states. These are terms you've probably heard of, right? The natural law. We all know people in this country who refuse to obey certain laws of the state because they think it conflicts with the natural law. We had a case like that recently in Kentucky. These are ideas that were embraced by Christianity especially, as well as Islam, and even by some Jewish thinkers to a certain extent. So we in the West are heirs to this tradition, and most people today, if you ask them, what do you think it would mean for a law to be divine? And I know this because I do it all the time. And I do it in my freshman seminar that I'm teaching right now on divine law. I have the kids go around, they have to tell me their name, and if someone said they had a divine law, what do you think that would mean? What would that law be like? And I can tell you that most people today, if you ask them what would make a law a divine law, they would say, well, I guess it would be true. And it would have to make sense. It wouldn't tell you to do things that didn't make sense, right? And it would apply to everybody because, you know, the divine would be universal. And it would never change if it's true. They give me the Greek definition of divine law, even those who feel they are strongly in the biblical tradition. And so we today also, we map onto divine law, or Torah, the characteristic features of the Greek conception of divine law. And so for us too, you smiled at some of these texts, right? Because the rabbinic construction of divine law can seem kind of scandalous. For a law that's divorced from truth, a single truth, or subject to change or evolution, well, that would surely have to be human. But who says? Perhaps there's something to be gained from bringing the rabbinic conception of divine law out of the shadows and from considering the possibility that a law and a text can be divine without being universal, absolute, unchanging truth. So I'm going to leave you with these provocative questions and one last text. What if the rabbis were right? What if the Torah was given not to prescribe an eternal fixed truth of some kind? What if the Torah was given to challenge us to think, to consider what justice and equity actually are, and not to settle for the claim that they're found in and confined to an inflexible rule? What if the Torah was given to encourage us to reason and to continually evaluate its claims and to disagree with it and to improve it? What if the Torah was given on the assumption that immersion in its modes of argumentation and instruction were intended to create respectful sparring partners for and critics of God? What if the Torah was given to allow the human voice to eclipse the divine voice sometimes in its moral clarity and interpretive authority? The ancient rabbis, I think, believed it was. I think they believed that God didn't give a fixed and inflexible law to be mechanistically or mindlessly applied, but a set of teachings, immersion in the subtleties of which, should lead to the formation of autonomous and intelligent moral beings. And on this view, God's greatest success and pleasure is found when humans take it upon themselves to serve as his moral critics, his partners, and to create from what they've been given something new and something greater. And so since we always have to end with a text, I would like to share with you a wonderful parable where the rabbis explain their understanding of the nature of divine law, the Torah in Israel, text 9. They do it with an analogy. To what can it be compared?
Text
10. To what can it be compared? To a king of flesh and blood who had two servants and loved them both with a perfect love. He gave each of them a measure of wheat and each a bundle of flax. What did the wise servant do? He took the flax and spun a cloth. He took the wheat and made flour. He cleaned the flour and ground, kneaded, and baked it and set it on top of the table. And then he spread the cloth over it and left it until the king would come. The foolish servant, however, did nothing at all. After some time, the king returned from a journey and came into his house, and he said to his servants, "My sons, bring me what I gave you." One servant showed the wheat, still in the box, with the bundle of flax upon it. Alas for his shame. Alas for his disgrace. When the Holy One, blessed be he, gave the Torah to Israel, he gave it only in the form of wheat for us to make flour from it, and flax for us to make a garment from it. Thank you so much for your attention tonight. I hope you could hear me back there. I was trying to project. I'm happy to entertain some questions if you have any. It's a lot. That was a lot. That was like a 400-page book in an hour. But yes.
One comment.
Yes.
I think you have opened the door for me in a way that I've never heard in Jewish life, and it's magnificent. And I think you must give this lecture to every Haredi.
I was thinking a YouTube channel.
A YouTube channel. So I did write a book, but it is long. It's easier to hear it in an hour.
Well, a follow-up to that. Have you spoken before Haredi audiences?
I wouldn't say I've spoken before Haredi audiences, although an individual person who would describe themselves as Haredi has from time to time been in audiences that I've spoken to. I wouldn't say Haredi. But there, I think there is an openness among a number of different kinds of communities, and I've spoken at Ma'ale Gilboa, which is a yeshiva. It's, you know, not, it is an Orthodox yeshiva, but, you know, they're very open to all sorts of ideas. And actually, the students there invited me. They went to the Rav, and they said, you know, would you please have her come and talk? And they had read the book. And I spoke at an Orthodox synagogue in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago as well. So I have actually just, and actually in Houston also, an Orthodox community invited me to Houston. And generally, I find the response is like the gentleman here. I just think all I have to do is get out of the way of the texts, honestly. I really think it's there for people to see and read, and sometimes it just takes someone to organize them in a certain way and help people see what's there, but it's really the texts that that say what they have to say, and I think when people read it, there's excitement, and you don't have to be a particular flavor of a Jewish community to feel that excitement.
So one thing that we discussed was sort of the divergence between sort of the Greek Hellenistic and Hebraic worldview, which I know is a major factor in what led to the Maccabean revolts and later the Hasmonean kingdom. And how did these different views of law, if you apply to sort of what happened,
Yeah. Led
up to those?
So I want to be as historically accurate as I can be. So what I'm describing is a conflict between what came out of the philosophical tradition in the Greek world. Okay? Because Greek society was also quite varied. And there were individual Greek communities. They believed in their gods. And many of them, the people of Sparta, for example, believed that their lawmaker, Lycurgus, had been given their laws by their god. They had that kind of notion too, and the philosophers made fun of their own Greek people who had that view. So what I'm describing to you is a conflict between a philosophical idea coming out of Greek culture when it met a very different idea in biblical culture. We could have had the same story within Greek culture itself, so just to be clear about that.
Okay.
So the philosophers were not in general the ones armed and fighting with Alexander. And so the conflicts, between the Greeks and the Jews in the land of Israel, these are political conflicts. These are not so much intellectual conflicts. However, having said that, it's a very interesting work called Fourth Maccabees, and Fourth Maccabees actually depicts a tyrant, a Greek tyrant, and the Jewish hero is named Eleazar. And he's trying to get him to break his law, trying to get him to eat pork, right? And we know that martyrdom really happens for the first time in the Maccabean period, where people are dying now for the first time for refusing to break their law. And it's interesting to read their conversation because it exactly plays this out. Now, it's written by a Jewish author. So it's the Jewish author who's looking at things this way. But the tyrant says, why do you cling to this silly philosophy? You're an elder man. How can you think a divine law would tell you can eat certain foods and not other foods? Nature is all one. All things can be eaten. Why? What kind of a divine law would make a distinction among naturally good things? You're being silly, old man. And Eleazar responds back, very much like Philo, because it's being written by someone who adopted these Greek ideas or valued these Greek ideas. No, our law is in line with nature, and it's teaching us discipline and to moderate our passions, and that's a virtue that even you Greeks would recognize, the man of moderation and temperance and wisdom. Those are the cardinal virtues, and our laws teach us that, and so on. So, yes, even in one of the texts that describes the conflict in the Maccabean era, they have a dialogue about law, and they understand that the Greeks coming in and fighting with them thought they were silly and that their law didn't make sense. It didn't look rational and it didn't look like divine law. So I think that's the closest, it wasn't a battle really between philosophers and sages, but even though it was a political battle, they still understood their culture to be being attacked in some of these ways and that the Greeks were devoted to reason. Which leads me to the interesting observation, and maybe we shouldn't record this, I don't know, but when I first wrote this book and I analyzed all these texts and I looked at Hellenistic Jewish authors who adopted this idea and they tried to make the law of Moses look like it was immutable and eternal and true and rational and so on, but that the rabbis pushed back against that and said the law is something much more between us and God, and it's a work in progress constantly, and God needs us. We're the local informants on the ground. Nice idea, God, but down here doesn't work so well. We need to adjust it, right? And a very different view of law. And then I thought, if you look at the modern heirs of those positions, it's a little ironic that a community sometimes that thinks of itself as being the most traditional is the one that has in some ways adopted the Greek idea of divine law. Mm-hmm. And I remember when that first hit me, that I thought that was ironic. I'll leave it at that. But I just think that the ideas have a wondrous history throughout time, and it's fascinating to see how they go and where they end up. Yeah.
The other irony here, as I see it, especially in the one where it says that the children have conquered, is that they're invoking God to validate their own negation of the divine.
And don't we all do that? I mean, you think of a child. No, but I mean in a positive way. I don't mean that in a self-serving way. Think about children, those of you who have children, right? Isn't it your desire that they grow up and be independent of you and make their own decisions? And you know there is... Yeah, you're not divine.
You are.
Right. Some sense you're... Well, but you are, but you have the wrong definition of divine. Right? God's divine, but the definition of divine is he's dynamic and he is listening. He's involved in history. Israel knows his God through community and history and action here on the ground. God is not an abstract principle we discover through rational thought, as he was for the Greek philosophers. Yeah. This is a God who's lived and felt. And so, yes, it is precisely his divine character which makes it possible for him to say, you know what, I'll step back and let you sort this out yourself by majority rule.
Rana?
Just to add on to that, I think an even deeper layer of irony is that he's misquoted, too.
Yes, he is, twice.
It says, after the majority, Martin majority must one incline.
Not what it says.
They forgot the word, no before that.
Yes,
so you can't go after the majority if they're, perverting justice.
Right. And that's been pointed out by people like Daniel Boyarin, that the very text they use to say the authority is ours to do this only means that if you accept the rabbinic midrashic interpretation of that verse, which is taken out of context. You're absolutely right. Yep.
First, so you said that the laws of Torah don't have to be rational, and you said it's not immutable, but it seems like the examples that you gave of when Torah laws did change have some rational basis behind it.
So this is always this is a difficult and tricky part of this. When I say rational, so there are two ways for something to be rational. Sorry to be very precise.
Let me just finish.
I thought that was
the end of the question. I think you're probably going to get to it anyway. Is have you looked at the rules of when Torah laws do get changed? What has to happen? I mean, I can't change the law.
Sure.
Either some authorities have to do it, or have to point to some other verse which may or may not be rational. So what...
And sometimes not. Sometimes it's actually just a sense of outrage. So
how do the laws get changed?
Yeah. So, I will repeat that I'm sort of the Talmud. There's a lot of stuff that happens between the 7th century, the close of the Talmud, and today. Jewish life takes on all sorts of forms, and institutions develop and rules, and we have something called a Shulchan Aruch, and there's all kinds of things that happen. But at least in the Talmudic world, there is a sense that while at the end of the day, obviously you need a decision sometimes, but we always need to understand that every decision has an asterisk next to it, okay? So, of course, there has to be some process or system for arguments to prevail enough, but we still register the majority view on the theory that that might at a future time be the view that needs to be revived and brought back, right? So the rabbis have systems and ways to decide things, to be able to live life as we must, but they do so always with that asterisk, that we're not claiming this is the absolute truth. The fact that the Mishnah itself is such an odd document. People refer to it as a law code, and it's not. It's not a law code. What kind of law code would look like, the city council decided there would be a $20 fine for jaywalking, except Council Member Jones thinks it should only apply during rush hour, and Council Member Smith thinks it should only apply, on weekdays. That's not a law code. That's, here's a snapshot in time of our legal discussions and where the majority is going with some dissenting opinions, and who knows, it might change a little bit tomorrow. So there are rules to make it, there are ways to make it functional, but again, always with that asterisk to keep that sense of dynamism. But the rationality question, the word rational, when the Greeks use it, they don't simply mean that it has a purpose. They mean that there's an inherent reason, and it has an intrinsic reason all by itself. So I stop at red for the rational purpose of not being in an accident. But there's nothing intrinsically about redness that makes me stop. And that's what they meant when they said divine law is reason itself. There's nothing about it that any human mind wouldn't automatically see and know intrinsically. That's really what they meant.
We'll take a last question from Mark.
Thank you, Professor. It's a wonderful lecture. Doesn't your thesis, you touched on it just now, extend beyond divine law? Seems to me you could have titled your book "What's So Divine About God?"
Yeah.
That the rabbis inverted the biblical notion that we were made in God's image, that they refashioned Him in ours. Isn't your thesis?
And it keeps going back and forth like that. So that's the next book. Okay. So I'd start small and build out. But yes, and I just touched on it so briefly at the beginning. I said to the extent that they have different notions of the divine, their notions of divine law will differ, and then I focused on divine law. But in the next book, I want to say more about those different notions of the divine. Because I think sometimes people cannot quite understand that the rabbi's notion of the divine is no less profound or reverential or worshipful for all of its humanness, and that it's possible to understand this God as both terribly intimate, someone you can really wrestle with, like Jacob, and like the name Israel even means, he who has wrestled with God, and yet still revere. We can revere someone we wrestle with, or something, or some concept that we wrestle with. But yes, so my next book, which will deal with humor and play, is also going to be getting at the notion of God as a dynamic agent in human society.
We'll have you back when the next book comes. You shall talk, Dr. Hayes. Blessed for your addition and your lecture tonight and your teaching us. Come celebrate with us. We have cake and champagne downstairs on the first floor to celebrate 30 years of Orzarua. So please let's collate downstairs on the first floor.
30 years of the community as a whole, 30 years of building, 30 years of the formation of the community.